of this edition of The Spotlight. I'd like to thank Tony Gosling, historian and journalist, and also I'd like to thank Mahmoud Rafat, president of the European Institute for International Law. That does it for this edition of The Spotlight. From Yacoub Itagwi and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how and what went so wrong for Prime Minister Liz Truss and her so-called mini-budget, with calls ringing louder for her resignation, and whether there's a lifeline for the UK economy or not. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Historian and journalist Tony Gosling joins us from London. Also joining us is President at the European Institute for International Law, Mahmoud Rafat, who joins us from Stockholm.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Tony Gosling, I'll first start with you. Basically, let's find out from you what is your explanation behind what is going on, especially when it comes to this mini-budget, which is now turned out to be a real crisis for Liz Truss and her premiership.
Well, I think there's a certain degree of sabotage going on within the British economy. We had a whole month during September where there was a leadership contest between Rishi Sunak and Liz Truss, and the promise that Truss gave to all of those Conservative Party members was, "I will reduce your taxes." Well, of course, they just were thinking with their wallets and voted for her. The trouble is that actually there is nowhere that she could reduce taxes at all, really, because the markets have reacted in the way that the only way they could, which is to say, well, if you're going to reduce taxes, that means that the government borrowing, it cannot be paid back, and therefore we're going to have to, really, I suppose, punish you and tell you that we want the government to be able to pay its debts, and that's what they've done. The markets have punished them. They've said, if you're going to be cutting taxes, you're not going to be able to fulfil your budgetary needs in paying all these debts back. The fact is, the only place where at the moment where Truss and the government can actually get enough tax in is from the super rich, and these are the one group of people and the most powerful businesses. The businesses are very good at not paying tax, by the way, but the super rich, as they get paid income in Britain, they have to, you know, it's very easy to take that tax off them, and she was going to cut that. So I mean, it was a disastrous policy from the start, just built on greed from the Conservative Party members voting for her. But as I said, I think there's an element of sabotage here. There are some powerful influences out there that do want to see economies crash. We've seen it in many other countries around the world. Okay. Argentina, I mean, the list goes on. And what happens is, as those economies start to crash, because most people think, well, you don't want that to happen, but some people do want that to happen, is they are then able to buy up all those assets for very little money and make an absolute fortune. We're talking about the people like George Soros, international dealers and traders that can make a fortune on a crash. This is the trouble, is the international markets, particularly those centred in the EU and in London, in the city, and in Wall Street, are basically like a casino. And so games are played, and that's what's been happening. And Liz Truss has completely lost touch with reality. This Chancellor, what they were doing is they were trying to do things which just had no economic sense to them whatsoever. And so I think now Kwarteng has gone, Liz Truss is going to have to go very soon because she backed him all the way. And the Conservative Party is going to have to find a new leader.
Well, we're going to get to those topics, especially the one that you say that there's maybe sabotage going on. But Mahmoud Rafat, if you can tell us in layman terms, what was so wrong with this mini budget that caused such a crisis, which has put into question the credibility of Liz Truss and her administration as a whole?
Well, which is appearing for us is the Texas problem and the bad plan which was put by the government of Truss, and especially to apply the same taxes on rich and poor, which represents a big contradiction with the social justice and also with the logic. But let's say, or let me repeat, this is what is appearing. Prime Minister Truss carried the heritage of long history of bad politics and also big messy. Don't forget, the Brexit is one of elements we can say not endamaged, but somehow broke big part of the British economy. Let's say also the markets in UK are not stable at all because of the big potentiality of the independence of Scotland next year, which will be followed for sure by independence of North Ireland.
Here's a look at our top stories this hour. The Yemeni army conducts a warning strike to stop the illegal shipping of Yemeni oil by the Saudi-led coalition. The Taliban say they've killed several Daesh operatives who were involved in a recent bloody attack on a female school. Plus, the European Union says it's witnessing an acceleration of tensions with China. Good to have you with us. Yemen's army says it has carried out a drone attack on a southern oil port to warn the Saudi-led coalition against plundering the country's resources. The army spokesman says what he called a basic warning strike was aimed at preventing a tanker from looting Yemeni crude through an oil terminal in Hadramaut province. Yahya Sadi says the vessel violated a ban on the transfer and export of Yemeni oil products. He also vowed more such strikes to prevent the plunder of the country's oil wealth. This is the first such incident since a UN-brokered truce between Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement and the Saudi-led coalition came to an end earlier this month. The coalition launched a devastating war on Yemen in 2015. Hamza Karim is a Yemeni activist and political commentator. He earlier gave us the background to the Yemeni army attack. Take a listen.
For the past 6 years, Saudi Arabia and UAE has been selling Yemen's oil, crude oil, and in return, all the revenue is going to Al Ahli Bank in Saudi Arabia, while Yemen and Yemeni people are going through the worst humanitarian crisis in the past 100 years, according to the UN. People haven't been paid their salaries for the past 6 years. And so today what happened is that the authorities in Sana'a, actually a week ago, right after the truce ended, they sent a clear message to the shipping companies that are shipping the oil from the oil terminals in Yemen to countries that are buying the oil, and they warned them that this is not a legal act, as the benefits of the oil and the return is not really going back to the Yemen and Yemeni people. And they warned them not to do that. But as we saw today, one of the companies actually sent its oil vessels. They tried to loot Yemen's oil, and a clear warning signal was sent from the authorities in Sana'a that after today, Yemen's oil should go or should benefit directly Yemeni people.
Moving on, all five Iranian crew members of a Venezuelan cargo plane that was grounded in Argentina back in June have arrived in Caracas. They are among 19 crew members of a Boeing 747 cargo plane grounded over alleged violation of U.S. sanctions. Venezuela's transport minister has expressed happiness over the freedom of all crew members who he said were kidnapped by the Argentine judiciary. The plane had been sold by Iran's Mahan Air to Venezuelan airline Amtrasar, both sanctioned by the U.S. The aircraft carrying auto parts landed in the Argentine capital en route from Mexico on June 6th. It was not permitted to refuel in Argentina, where authorities detained its crew on the request of a U.S. court. An Argentinian judge recently said the documents provided by the plaintiff were insufficient and invalid. Syria says it has intercepted another Israeli missile attack over Damascus shortly after reports of explosions in the airspace of the capital city. The Syrian Defense Ministry says the missiles were targeted at areas in the vicinity of Damascus. It says air defenses shut down most of the missiles, adding that the attack caused limited material damage. That's the first such air raid in more than a month. Israel has carried out hundreds of strikes against Syria, targeting government troops as well as allied forces. One of the latest such attacks hit around the capital, Damascus, in September, killing five army soldiers. A funeral has been held for a 19-year-old Palestinian who lost his life during an Israeli raid on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. Mourners condemned Israeli crimes and called for justice. Salah Bariki died after being shot in the neck as Israeli forces stormed Jenin in the early hours of Friday. Three other Palestinians were also wounded during the raid. In reaction, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas stressed that the raids won't undermine Palestinians' determination to liberate all of Palestine. Hamas also pledged that it won't let the Palestinians' blood be spilled in vain. For months, the Israeli military has been conducting a brutal campaign to quash growing resistance in Jenin, killing dozens of Palestinians during its raids. The latest victim brings to 124 the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank this year. The Taliban in Afghanistan say they have killed six Daesh terrorists in an operation in the capital, Kabul. They say the terrorists were involved in two major attacks in recent weeks. For more on that, I'm now joined by our correspondent in Kabul, Rahmatullah Bawan. Rahmatullah, it's good to talk to you. Please give us more details.
Hello, thank you for having me. It seems like yesterday was a good and successful day for the Taliban intelligence forces because yesterday they carried out two raids and attacks on Daesh terrorist group hideouts in Kabul. First, in the west of Kabul, they attacked a hideout of the Daesh terrorist group and arrested two Daesh members. After that, around evening, they attacked an area in the police district of Kabul, PDA. People here didn't know that what was going on because people were hearing clashes and crossfires here in Kabul city. Then the Taliban announced that they're carrying out an attack on Daesh terrorist group hideout. Today morning, the Taliban main spokesman, the Abdullah Mujahid, said in a newsletter that they successfully carried out an attack on a Daesh hideout in PDA and killed six Daesh members. According to the Abdullah Mujahid, this Daesh terrorist members were involved in two major attacks in Kabul, which took place in...
I think we lost Rahmatullah Bahwan there. We'll try to get back to him at a later point in time, but for now, let's move on. The United States looks set to have greater influence over the EU as the bloc's leaders seek to become less dependent on imports from Russia and China. Washington is stepping in to replace Moscow as the EU's major energy supplier, but the associated costs are enormous. Jerome Hughes reports from Brussels.
EU leaders at a summit in Brussels agreed China is becoming too assertive. It's the same phrase they have been using for years with respect to Russia. Iran was also in their sights. New restrictive measures against Tehran were rubber-stamped.
Sanctions have been taken against those who are participating in the repression of peaceful demonstrations, and this, of course, is linked to the support of Russia against Ukraine.
Analysts say the allegations against Iran are spurious and they are being vehemently contested. It's pointed out that the bloc sometimes ignores clear international law violations, even when there's zero ambiguity, for example, those perpetrated by Israel against Palestinians. The US is set to have even greater influence over the EU as the bloc moves to try and isolate Moscow and Beijing. It's suggested that has been Washington's plan all along.
Europe, they are totally dependent on the United States and in energy field and in military field, and that is dependency that doesn't allow them to conduct independent foreign policies.
Sanctions against Russia over the war in Ukraine have driven energy costs to unmanageable levels. A complex package has been agreed in principle by EU leaders to try and lower prices and demand.
There's a lot of work now ahead of us what the energy is concerned, but the roadmap is very clear, and it was good to have this unanimity, this broad support for the roadmap that we have put forward.
Leaders admit the energy package is very complex and will take up to 3 weeks to try and finalise. Will this summit deliver positive results for EU citizens? It's a crucial question for millions of households and businesses, but also a vital political question for the bloc's leaders. Extreme left and extreme right anti-EU parties are waiting in the wings. Ignoring massive corruption findings by their own financial watchdog, EU leaders have agreed to provide 18 billion euro to the Ukrainian government in 2023. But that's nothing compared to what they will spend on lethal weapons for the country's army. Jerome Hughes at the EU Leaders Summit, Brussels.
In Italy, far-right leader Giorgia Meloni has been appointed the country's first female prime minister. Meloni received a mandate to form the new government from the Italian president on Friday. The incoming premier also already announced her cabinet picks. She is set to be sworn into office on Saturday. Meloni's Brothers of Italy is leading a far-right coalition after winning the parliamentary elections nearly a month ago. Her government is pitted against major economic challenges, including high inflation and rising energy bills. Italy, as the Eurozone's third largest economy, along with much of Europe, is struggling with soaring energy costs, partly due to the ongoing war in Ukraine and Western sanctions on Russia. Conservative British lawmakers are declaring who they're backing to become the party leader and next prime minister after Liz Truss's resignation left the position up for grabs. So far, former Prime Minister Boris Johnson and his former Finance Minister Rishi Sunak are leading the race with the most backing from MPs. Many British politicians doubt that Johnson will receive the 100 nominations he needs from lawmakers to run for the position. They are citing a lack of confidence in Johnson as his recent premiership was blighted with scandals and allegations of misconduct. Penny Mordaunt, who was popular with party members, is the only one to formally declare her candidacy for Tory leadership so far. Liz Truss quit on Thursday after only 6 weeks in office. There were growing calls for her to resign over a host of issues, including her controversial economic package. A new survey has found millions of households in Britain are skipping meals as they struggle with the country's deepening cost of living crisis. The findings show inflation returns to a 40-year high after food prices soar. Said Pureza reports from London.
It's been just a few weeks since the now resigned Prime Minister, Liz Truss, promised low taxes and high growth. Events have moved incredibly fast in Westminster that a new finance minister is now raising taxes and promising public sector cuts. The U-turns and counter-U-turns have come with a cost for the economy and the people. A new study has found that millions of households are skipping meals or struggling to put healthy foods on the table. Inflation is already at more than 10%. Energy and fuel prices are on the rise, putting a squeeze on Britain's finances.
Well, the start of all this is Brexit. Brexit led to Boris and incompetence. It led to falling living standards. It led to Liz Truss and further incompetence. And Britain basically voted to become poorer by leaving the EU. You can blame some of it on money printing at the Bank of England, inflation taking out, you know, and lowering living standards as well. So it's a combination of things.
A combination of things that have toppled two prime ministers in the span of 1 year.
It's been less than 2 months since Boris Johnson gave way to Liz Truss as prime minister, followed by the death of the Queen and a dramatic change in the country's economic outlook. And now, yet another leadership contest that could trigger even more economic and political instability.
And more instability means more people relying on charities, from food banks to keep their stomachs full, and warm rooms where those unable to heat their homes can take refuge in the cold months of winter. The new chancellor has curbed Liz Truss's flagship economic plan of a 2-year cap on energy bills to April next year. And at the end of this month, he's expected to announce a midterm economic policy that could spell out the beginning of another prolonged period of austerity.
Whoever takes over, Boris, Rishi, Mordaunt, who knows? But the outlook continues to be bad because inflation is still out of control. There's not the money or the government finances to give the public sector further wage rises to match that inflation. Strikes will continue. The fiscal position of the country remains dire, partly because we have a smaller economy because of Brexit. So there's no easy solution. There's no easy way out of this. The hole has been dug and it's very deep. And very difficult to climb out of.
Paying the price of that, ordinary Britons, as the Conservative Party races to choose its third leader and prime minister in 1 year, urgent help to those in need couldn't come any sooner. Sai Purisa, London.
Iran's Kish Island has hosted an exhibition of investment opportunities called Kish Invex. The international event has brought under one roof local and foreign investors. Yusuf Jalali reports.
The biggest investment event in Iran. Every year, Kish Invex attracts businesses active in stock exchange, banking and insurance to the southern Kish Island to present the country's investment opportunities to local and foreign investors.
Tinex was launched.
Our brand has been operating for 30 years in the capital market. We offer services to business people regarding business marketing. So we help companies expand their business in foreign markets despite the sanctions that target Iranian firms.
Organized by Kish Free Zone Organization, the event also seeks to introduce the investment capacities of Kish Island with a focus on tourism and transport, as the Persian Gulf Island is one of the hot spots of tourism in the country.
The most silent area is beach tourism, which needs some $3 million of investment to be developed.
With a population of roughly 82 million, Iran is a country with numerous potentials for investment. However, the doors to this market have been closed following the U.S.'s unilateral pullout from the 2015 deal and the reinstatement of sanctions on Tehran. Now, with the multilateral accord in limbo, the country is adopting new incentives to facilitate foreign investment.
We are trying to ensure the security of investment in Iran for international investors. One of the safest methods is to launch offshore banks and offshore stock exchange. An offshore bank works as a consortium of domestic and foreign banks.
Aside from incentives for international investment, the country is also adopting new policies to facilitate domestic investment as well.
With U.S. measures haunting Iran's banking system, international investment has largely shrunk in the country. However, Kish Invex says it has gathered up some of the big names of the country's capital market with the hope that they will work to fill the void of foreign investment. Yusuf Jalali from Kish Island.
That's your world news for now. Stay with us.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
On Saturdays. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Bismillah, words that seekers of sanctuary repeatedly recite. Words that the very cautious in search of protection often repeat. I seek refuge with Allah, the Exalted above all, from the oppression of the unjust, from the deceitful malice the envious use to lay snares and traps, from the injustice and outrage of the tyrants, and I sing his praise. Do better and go beyond other praisers. O Allah, thou art one, has no partner, and is the Lord and Master without being made. There is no discrepancy or nonsense in thy commands, nor there is lawlessness in thy kingdom. I beseech thee to send blessings on Muhammad, thy servant, thy messenger. To let me ask thee for enlightenment and inspiration, so as to be thankful for thy bounties, which alone get thy approval ultimately. To help me to obey thee and instinctively worship thee, and make me deserve thy rewards on account of thy very patronage. And have mercy on me, and prevent me from breaking in the bounds of thy prohibitions, as far as I am kept alive, and show the way unto that which is useful and advantageous till I go on survive. To let me take to heart the meanings of thy book, and by its reading, throw down the heavy burden of sins, and receive welfare and salvation as a gift. Let not my family and friends who love me leave me alone. Let thy favors reach me in abundance during the remainder of my life, exactly as they used to be made available for me, in full, in the days gone by. O, the Most Merciful.
Analysis of recent events in Iran. In this program, we examine Western efforts to create turmoil, instability, and civil war in Iran, as well as Western efforts to disintegrate and break up the Islamic Republic. Please stay with us. One of the principal objectives of the enemies of the Islamic Revolution has been to bring about the collapse of the Islamic Republic and the disintegration of Islamic Iran. This has been their main objective since the victory of the Islamic Revolution in February of 1979. They have used every opportunity to strike a blow at Iran. Their hostility knows no bounds. This amount of hostility, plots and schemes directed at a popular democratic nation is certainly rare, if not unprecedented. The soft war being waged against Iran by mainstream Western media, the media campaign against Iran by American and British media are all part of Western efforts during the past 43 years to stifle the Islamic Republic. The current unrest and rioting in Iran can also be seen through this perspective. The Zionist regime of Israel and some backward reactionary Arab regimes of the region have also tried to fuel the unrest in Iran. When Islamic Iran was just a fledgling state back in 1979, separatist and secessionist groups became active, particularly in the border regions of the country, in provinces such as Kurdistan, Khuzestan, and Azerbaijan. The terror groups used guns against the people, ironically, in the name of the people. This separatist sedition was still playing out when the not-so-clever former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, egged on by both the West and the East, decided to invade Iran militarily. The Ba'athist army crossed Iran's southern and western borders, initiating a full military invasion, and somewhat naively, they expected to push all the way to the capital, Tehran, in a matter of days. But unexpectedly for the Ba'athists, they encountered a massive and determined Iranian resistance. Resistance by the Iranian people. 8 years of war followed, and a much more powerful and modern Iran emerged after the fighting. In the years following the war, Iran made enormous progress in many areas of science and technology, including aerospace technology, peaceful civilian nuclear technology, biotechnology and stem cell research, microelectronics and nanotechnology. Iran also made huge strides in development of military hardware and weapon systems, so much so that we became a regional power in West Asia, and no one even dared to think about attacking us. Surprisingly, all this progress was made in the years following the 8-year imposed war, when Western countries, led by the United States of America, slapped the most stringent of sanctions and boycotts against Islamic Iran. Former US President Donald Trump unilaterally withdrew the United States from the landmark nuclear accord with Iran in May of 2018, to the surprise of everyone. Donald Trump didn't like the agreement because it was reached by his predecessor, Barack Obama, and he decided to follow a policy of maximum sanctions and maximum pressure against Tehran. This was tantamount to economic terrorism against the Islamic Republic. Just 3 years later, at the end of his presidency, Donald Trump was forced to acknowledge that his policy of maximum sanctions had been a failure and had not achieved any of its objectives. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, commented on this policy of maximum sanctions by saying, "They pulled out all the stops. They did everything they could to break the resistance and the will of the Iranian people. They used economic pressure and cultural assault. Whenever a country resists the hegemonic powers, they try to make it passive and inactive. The biggest mistake one can make against the enemy is to be passive and inactive. This is a huge mistake. We must never regard the enemy as weak or unworthy. We must always regard the enemy as dangerous. We must always be prepared to confront the enemy, be vigilant and alert, and we must never be afraid of the enemy. We must not be intimidated by it. Remember, the biggest mistake is to be inactive and passive vis-à-vis the enemy. Despite the huge economic pressure, the Iranian nation has succeeded in neutralizing and bypassing many of the unjust sanctions imposed against us. But this did not signify an end to the hostilities against Islamic Iran by United States and its European allies. Their aim is to split Iranian society, open up a chasm between young Iranians and the government, pit Iranians against one another. They don't want just regime change in Tehran, they want to create a civil war inside Iran and disintegrate the country, splitting it into several regions. In the words of the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, "The US is not just against the Islamic Republic, it is also against a strong, independent Iran. They are after the Iran of the Pahlavi era. Iran was to them a milking cow. The Shah submitted to their orders, and when in quandary, he often asked to see the US ambassador or the British ambassador to ascertain what course of action he should take. How can the Iranian nation tolerate this shame? This is what the enemies want. They are opposed to an independent and a powerful Iran." The leader has also commented on the double standards of the United States and the West with regards to the recent riots in Iran. He said, "Many riots take place in the world. Every now and then, there are large riots in Europe, especially in France and in Paris. But has the US President or the US House of Representatives ever supported the rioters and issued a statement? Is there any record of them sending a message saying that we stand with the demonstrators in France? Is there any record of the mass media, which is affiliated with American capitalism and the US client regimes, such as some regional governments like Saudi Arabia, supporting rioters in those countries? But such support against the Islamic Republic of Iran has happened repeatedly. There is no doubt that the enemies of the Islamic Republic use every opportunity and every means at their disposal to strike a blow against Iran. They are currently using social media networks to wage an extensive media campaign, a fully-fledged media war against Iran. They can use a variety of issues, such as the sad death of a young girl, to initiate turmoil and rioting within the country." There is dissatisfaction within Iran with regards to the government's performance and the current economic situation of the country. What is certain is that peoples of many other countries are also dissatisfied with the performance of their governments. For example, in many European countries we see industrial action, we see demonstrations and protests in response to rising food and fuel prices, rising inflation and the cost of living crisis. But in none of those European countries do we see active support from outside of the country for the demonstrators, for those who engage in rioting, and we don't see interference in the internal affairs of those countries by the United States and Canada. The United States, Canada, and some European countries are more Catholic than the Pope. They pretend to care about the Iranian people, even more so than the Iranian government, and they criticize the Iranian security forces for attempting to establish order and peace in the country. They openly interfere in the internal affairs of the Islamic Republic and stoke tensions within the country. But their own dreadful human rights record and long-running persecution and genocide of indigenous peoples makes them particularly unsuitable for lecturing on this issue. For example, the recent grim discovery of a mass grave containing the remains of hundreds of Indigenous Canadian children, Canada's First Nation, who were forcibly taken away from their families and taken to special schools where they were mistreated and persecuted. Or the centuries-long persecution and killing of Native Americans in the United States. Given this background, how on earth can they claim the moral high ground? Under these circumstances, The Canadian Prime Minister threatens Iran with sanctions, using the unfortunate death of a young Iranian woman as a pretext. Social media sites are currently doing all they can to create turmoil and crisis in Iran. Western governments are making instrumental use of these social media sites to spread disinformation, prevarication and lies in Iran. These particularly target young Iranians. No doubt, the Iranian nation, particularly the younger generation, will overcome the current difficulties and will navigate their way through the crisis which has been created by the West. No doubt, the Islamic Republic of Iran will maintain its independence, will maintain its strength and authority, and will emerge with flying colours from this difficult period.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limit and neutralize Hashda Shaabi's activities with full respect. The Washington Institute for Near East Policy made this decision to get rid of Al-Rafidain Alliance in Iraq.
The Dark Room.
Introduction on Washington Institute for Near East Policy. The Washington Institute for Near East Policy is based in Washington, D.C. This institute is a kilometer away from the White House. It is called the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. This institute was established in 1985. Its mission statement says that it seeks to advance American interests in West Asia. Who is Martin Indyk? He's Jewish. He created the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He was the former research assistant in American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC. Martin Indyk served as the U.S. ambassador to Israeli regime for two terms, articulated the quote-unquote dual containment strategy for Iran and Iraq.
Israel is getting the benefit of that growing recognition and acceptance in the Arab world, which started with with Egypt and the Israel-Egypt peace treaty, and has advanced all of this time in which we've been talking about the travails with the Palestinians, the relations with the Arab states grown and developed.
Martin Indyk is a British-born Jew who is now an American citizen. He created the Washington Institute for Near East Policy to serve American interests and policies in West Asia. He is the only non-American to have reached the rank of ambassador. Martin Indyk served as the U.S. ambassador to the Israeli regime for 2 terms, serving the United States and Israel at the same time. He's a member of the U.S. National Security Council. He received confidence vote from both main U.S. parties, the Republicans and the Democrats. He was also a key member in Camp David Accords. He has dedicated a 40-year effort to paving the way for peace and reconciliation in West Asia, and he makes it as clear as possible that over the past 40 years, he has been absolutely convinced that compromise or peace is possible in West Asia.
For 35 years, I've been essentially devoted my life to trying to achieve a secure peace for Israel.
Martin Indyk introduced the quote-unquote dual containment strategy for Iran and Iraq. He believed in the theory of dual containment during the presidency of Bill Clinton. According to this theory, in order to serve the interests of Israel, they had to build an economic and technological fence to change the governments in Iraq and Iran so that the countries of the region would not follow them.
I think makes them very nervous, and that's why the Prime Minister is coming out much more vocally than one might have expected in the midst of an election campaign here. Saying, you know, we need reassurances, we need red lines against the Iranians, because from his point of view, that's the greatest threat they face. That's the greatest threat they face.
Now, and after the assassination of Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy advises its policymakers to either consider introducing a new leader far from Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis's ideas, or dissolving Heshta Shaabi. Another suggestion is to focus on limiting its organization and filling the vacancy of Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis with a person based on their taste. Of course, the group's patience for achieving their goals is so great that the founder of this think tank spent 35 years of his life realizing the idea of creating Israel from the Nile to the Euphrates. I went back into government to work with Secretary of State Kerry and President Obama again to try to negotiate a final status agreement for the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. So it was a kind of continuation of that effort, a continuation of 35 years of obsession on my part with trying to find a way to achieve a peaceful resolution of the Arab-Israeli conflict. Michael Knights is another Washington think tank expert who is known for his occasional travels to Iraq. He had previously said that they need someone like General Qasem Soleimani in Iraq to unite their forces and integrate and use all the instruments of their national power. From the Washington Institute's point of view, now is the time for the unification of American forces after the martyrdom of General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, provided that Hashd al-Shaabi would be contained and weakened shortly and dissolved and surrendered at a future date. Hashd al-Shaabi is currently based on a reasonably weak organizational framework and consists of less than 20 pages of law related to public, general executive orders issued to people, and cabinet decisions. This view will change if the Iraqi government implements existing laws and regulations, such as Military Service and Retirement Law No. 3 of 2010 or the Military Penal Code No. 19 of 2007. The Shaabi forces must be respectfully contained. In the second step of the scenario, this group must be stripped of its spiritual identity and replace livelihood with religious laws and religion. In the Washington Institute version, membership in Hashd al-Shaabi with certain rights is the key to monitoring Arafidine lions. Until the membership of Hashd is defined, fixed, and transparent, any audit of the behavior of its member will be difficult. If and when comprehensive audits are undertaken, they must be done by an independent body, not the Hashd itself. Hashd al-Shaabi's three operational units, including local units, units stationed in southern Iraq, and finally, wandering units, must not comment negatively about the occupation, and this is to contain Hashd al-Shaabi respectfully. Leadership acts like a parallel state. It runs a parallel judicial system and prisons, a parallel illicit economy, and a parallel war effort that undermines unity of command across the entire Iraqi security forces. The Washington think tank strategy is to stop growing power of Hashd al-Shaabi in the first place in order to mobilize all elements of power in Iraq, including the government and authority against them. The think tank's final goal is to create a united front against the existence of Hashd al-Shaabi, including all the countries that have interests in Iraq. Of course, it takes about 5 to 10 years to realize this idea. Firstly, Hashd al-Shaabi's growing power must be stopped. At this stage, Hashd al-Shaabi's activities, its budget and institutional infrastructure are still limited and they must stay at the same level. Undoubtedly, the assassination of Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis provided an opportunity in this case. This opportunity was realized by concentrating too much power among a limited number of commanders of Hashd al-Sha'bi, provided that the Iraqi government, Islamic seminaries, and international powers come together. Although the plan of Hashd al-Sha'bi's respectful restraint is defined in the long run, but it tries to seize the opportunities. According to the plan, it would be preferable to start the operation by changing the form and structure, first by changing the logo of Hashd al-Sha'bi. Afterwards, a hero approved by the government and the authority is introduced and supported as the new leadership of Hashd al-Sha'bi. Finally, the plan suggests the integration of Hashd al-Sha'bi units, so there will be changes in the structure of the popular mobilization units. So they would just play the role of a unit defending one of the small holy places. In this way, Hashd al-Sha'bi will be respected and its identity will be emptied. Start your work by changing the structure and form. In the first step, start changing Hashd al-Sha'bi's logo with a foreign version. Then, activate and strengthen a reform hero with the support of the Iraqi Prime Minister and the Islamic Seminary. The chosen hero must be popular and courageous, and his relationship with religious institutions must probably be beyond criticism. Talking about security, they have to design a single organizational logo for tactical units, integrate small and large units of Hashd al-Sha'bi into light infantry units, and integrate heavy weapons into sections with dedicated and secure warehouses. By considering a convincing argument beyond the idea, it would be great in 10 years to have forces like a parallel national force, similar to Basij in Iran, to protect sacred shrines that will be partially or completely mobilized at all times. If we consider the influential figures in the history of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy and review the approach of the Institute's expert advisors, we come to understand that all of these political, military, and media figures pursue a common goal, which is preserving U.S. and Israeli interests in dominating West Asia.
Henry Kissinger has been a friend of mine. I've liked him, I've respected him, but we've been friends for a long time, long before my emergency.
Henry Kissinger, Jewish, former U.S. Secretary of State under Richard Nixon and convicted of war crimes. Robert Satloff, the executive director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, specialist in the Arab and Islamic world, and the only non-Arab presenter of the American network Al-Hurra in Iraq. Warren Christopher, Deputy Secretary of State under President Jimmy Carter, Secretary of State under Bill Clinton, private investigator of Arab-Israeli Peace Project. Alexander Haig, NATO Supreme Allied Commander under President Richard Nixon, U.S. Deputy Secretary of State under Ronald Reagan.
I'm deeply grateful, Mr. President.
Robert McFarlane, U.S. Marine Corps Officer, National Security Advisor to President of the United States, Ronald Reagan.
Arabs looking at Iraq could see...
Richard Perle, Member of Senate Armed Services Committee, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Global Strategic Affairs under President Ronald Reagan, known as American Dracula, one of the main motivators of the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
I do think there's probably a new look...
Dennis Ross, U.S. Representative in the Middle East peace process under President George W. Bush, and President Bill Clinton, Special Assistant to President Barack Obama, Special Advisor to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton.
By several facts, and fact number one... And
Paul Wolfowitz, the 10th President of the World Bank, Assistant Secretary of State under Bush and Reagan, architect of the U.S. war against Iraq. Will the strategy of this APAC's resource in eliminating Hashd-e Sha'bi be able to realize the Zionist dream of 70 years to form a greater Israel from the Nile to the Euphrates? Actually, this time starting from the Euphrates. Our Rafidein lions seem to be quite vigilant in the face of Israeli plans.
In the limelight.
Hypocrisy has no limits as far as the West is concerned. The French cement company Lafarge SA was indicted in U.S. District Court in Brooklyn, New York, on the criminal charge related to the French company's payments to the terror outfits Daesh and Al-Nusra Front to keep its cement plant operating in Syria. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press International wrote that the terror group ISIS, also known as Daesh, is a Western creation and supported by Western regimes, has once again been confirmed. The French cement company Lafarge SA was indicted in U.S. District Court in Brooklyn, New York on October 18th, but no individuals have been charged so far, according to CNBC. The investigation into the company's misdemeanors is ongoing. In pleading guilty, Lafarge SA has agreed to pay a fine of $777.8 million. The criminal charge related to the French company's payments to the terror outfits Daesh and Al-Nusra Front to keep its cement plant operating in Syria. More than $10 million were paid to the terrorist outfits from August 2013 through 2014. This was in exchange for the terror outfits allowing employees of the company to pass through their checkpoints in areas under their control. CNBC reported that payments were being made even as the terror group was kidnapping and killing Westerners. Obviously, kidnapping Muslim civilians and killing them has never been an issue and does not elicit any condemnation. It still continues in areas under Daesh control. Lafarge has admitted and taken responsibility for its staggering crime, U.S. Attorney Breon Pease said in a statement. Never before has Western Corporation been charged with providing material support and resources to foreign terrorist organizations, it said. Peace's office said Lafarge Cement Syria executives bought materials needed for the cement plant in the Jalabiya region of northern Syria from ISIS-controlled suppliers. In return, it paid monthly donations to ISIS and al-Nusra so that employees, customers, and suppliers could cross checkpoints around the plant without fear of being kidnapped for ransom. Lafarge Cement Syria eventually agreed to make payments to ISIS based on the volume of cement that LCS sold to its customers, which Lafarge and LCS executives likened to paying taxes, Pease's office said. It wasn't taxes, but protection money, and it served the West's larger agenda of keeping Syria in turmoil. Lafarge was purchased by Switzerland-based Halsey.